Okay, yeah.
This is what I mean when I say titles. This is like concrete music. Good. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this afternoon session with Aaron Benanov around his book, Automation and the Future of Work. My name is Antonio Casilli. I'm a professor of sociology in Paris at the Institut Polytechnique de Paris. And I will mainly be the facilitator of this event. And I'm very happy and proud to welcome Aaron Benanov, who is an assistant professor at the Department of Sociology at the Syracuse University in New York. He is also actually half a sociologist, half a historian, and you will soon discover that along our conversation, probably this other thread of your production will eventually surface. He holds a PhD and an MA in history from the University of California, Los Angeles, and he was a member of the Society of Fellows at the University of Chicago. Today we are here to introduce and celebrate the Italian translation of his book, Automation and the Future of Work. It has been translated and published by the Lewis University Press under the title Automazione, Disuguaglianza, Occupazione, Povertà e la fine del lavoro come lo conosciamo. So it's a very long Wertmüller title. So Lina Wertmüller is an Italian director. They know what I'm talking about. And basically, this book is, and I should say, and this is why I'm very happy being here, this is a short, punchy, crispy book that contains a lot of information that makes some very valuable points in only 150 pages. So this is also important to underline. Sorry, and in this book, basically, Aaron Benanov tackles the myth of automation, especially the displacement effects of labor and of automation on labor, and basically he introduces three counter arguments, and today we will review this. Four counter arguments. I forgot one. I don't know why. It's actually three counter arguments and a political proposal at the end. And today we will review these four counter arguments. I would like to start, if you are comfortable with this, a quotation that comes not from your book, but from an article that was published by historian Edward Jones Imhotep in a journal called History and Technology. And this article was actually about the history, or even the prehistory, of the ghost factories, the factories without workers. And while discussing the 1745 invention of the Vaucanson machine, which was like a knitting machine, he basically said that seeing machines as autonomous has historically meant not seeing certain kinds of labor and the people performing it. And he goes on by saying, at the heart of all his work, of Vaucanson's work as an inventor and an innovator, including his spectral account of factory production, was a set of erasures, physical and rhetorical, that made the illusion of automation possible. Where were the artisans who built those automated machines, who spun the threads that waved themselves into impossible fine fabric? Where were the Chinese and North African and West Indian laborers who gathered the silk and cotton from far-flung trading posts and colonies? It's only at the end of his striking account that Vaucanson revealed the hidden organic forces powering his automatic looms. So this is one way of, entering the topic of your book, which focuses on today's automation. But this is also one way of saying that the myth of automation has been around for centuries. So what do we do about it, and why did you choose to especially focus on it in your book?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting quotation. And I think it captures that, what we're talking about today when we talk about automation, robotics, artificial intelligence, and the way that these technologies seem poised to obliterate all of these jobs. It produces so much fear in people about what the future will look like. Like, how are we going to survive and find work in a world of automating technologies? And also a kind of, you know, dream or utopian possibility. What would it mean to live in a world where we don't have to work? Those questions, both the fears and the hopes, have been around for a very, very long time. And when we talk about automation, we need to try to distinguish between two separate, you know, trends or events, as it were. We have to separate, let's say, the trend from the event. Because on the one hand, it's certainly true that the long history of capitalism is a history of continuous innovation and technological change and changing jobs. Productivity grows, jobs, you know, become very important and then sort of disperse and fall away, and people have to change their work. That has been a constant of capitalism. But then periodically, in a history of capitalism, but even a history that goes back far before capitalism, we've had these moments where people become very excited about the possibility that they live in an age of automation, that jobs are really going to disappear. In the book, I talk about maybe four big events. One was really during the Industrial Revolution itself. These figures like Charles Babbage, who is said to have invented the first computer, in the time he was writing, in the 1820s, 1830s, there was this major theory that we were living through an age of automation. It was going to get rid of all the jobs. Karl Marx was very influenced by reading the texts of these early automation theorists. Then you might look at the 1920s and 30s, this big discussion about technological unemployment and the Great Depression, another major moment where people thought technology was finally going to get rid of all the jobs. In the 1950s and 60s, it happened again with the computer and these giant mainframe computers, this vision of automation that was going to finally get rid of all the jobs. And then again, you know, maybe even more frequently, there was a little moment in the 80s, in the 90s, and then really in the 2010s, you had this excitement, both the hope and the fear of automation. And what I say, you know, putting our current period in that longer historical context lets us think about, you know, what is it about these moments of technological change? What is it that sometimes, as technologies are changing, generates these periods of hope and fear about the end of work? In my view, in the book, I say that these are moments that what defines them is that there are moments when people really are struggling to find jobs. There are periods of time in the history of capitalism where it becomes very difficult for a lot of people to find work. And we see that today, right? There's all of this conversation about not just unemployment, but underemployment, precarious labor, informal work around the world. There's clearly all of these people who need work and can't find it. And the automation story is one way of explaining why that happens, right? It's important to think about other explanations that also recur historically. You know, periodically we have Malthusian explanations of why people can't find work that have much less of a positive hope part of the story. They're mostly discourses of fear. We have anti-Semitic discourses periodically, right, that blame the Jews and their, you know, search for gold for why so many people have trouble finding work. So I think what differentiates the automation discourse to me is that it has this very positive potential idea within it compared to some other explanations of why people have trouble finding work. But what the automation discourse, I think, sometimes acts as a screen, it kind of blocks us from thinking about, is what's happening to all the workers in this period of technological change, what the actual experiences of work are like. Because the story of automation makes it seem like all the jobs are going to disappear, so don't pay too much attention to all the people who are currently struggling to find work or struggling to organize, struggling to change the work that they're doing. Don't worry about all of the Uber drivers and Deliveroo delivery people, because soon, you know, and the Amazon warehouse workers, all of those people those jobs are about to be done by robots anyway. So there's some important aspect of the automation discourse, I would say, that is about distraction. Distraction from the jobs people are actually still doing. But it all, and then these other two components I already talked about. So we think about the automation discourse as a discourse of fear, a discourse of hope, and a discourse of distraction. And those are some of the different things that I talk about in my book.
And actually, the main point, or the first point at least, that you make in your book is that the problem is not with automation per se, but with the labor market when automation is leveraged as an explanation or a factor that might explain what happens. And again, if I may, I would like to quote one part of the book, one sentence of the book. What summons the automation discourse periodically into being is a deep anxiety about the functioning of the labor market. There are simply too few jobs for too many people. So this is actually the first counter argument that you make in your book, that there is a decrease in the demand for labor in the past decades, and we have witnessed it. There is no way of denying it, but this is not due to technological innovation. Mm. This is due to widespread industrial and economic stagnation. So could you please develop on that?
Yeah, so one of the big points I make in the book, and it can be hard to believe if you're engineer or, you know, even if you, like everyone, if you have a smartphone in your pocket, it feels so intensely like we live in an era of incredible technological change and possibility. You know, we're told that, you know, artificial general intelligence is around the corner, that machines are just about to be driving cars and trucks. They're going to take over the jobs of lawyers and even doctors, as well as, you know, day laborers and construction workers. So we're hearing all the time, and we feel like we see in the internet and smartphones and so on, all of this evidence that we live in an era of just incredibly rapid technological change. And one of the things that I'm here to tell you is that from the most standard economic perspective, it's very surprising to learn that from an economic perspective, what all the economic statistics say is that we actually live in a period of rather slow technological change from an economic perspective. Instead of labor productivity rising at a faster pace than ever before, which would happen if people were being replaced by machines, and if machines were doing more of the work, then the number of hours of labor it would take to generate all of this additional production would be much smaller, and that would show up in the statistics as a very fast pace of labor productivity growth. But in our era, labor productivity is growing at a slower pace than it has in 70 years. We live in a period of very slow technological change. And this is very surprising. And actually, one of the most famous mainstream economists, Robert Solow, named this. It's called the Solow paradox. He said, we see computers everywhere in society, but not actually in the productivity statistics. So the question is, why are people having so much trouble finding work? Why is there so much precarious labor in the global north and informal labor in the global south? Why are people having so much trouble, why do so many people feel so insecure in their jobs? The answer is actually that the economy has been growing more and more slowly. Italy, of course, like Japan, is an extreme case of economic stagnation. The degree of stagnation in Italy is they're at the far end of that process. But it's not only happening here. It's not only an Italian and Japanese phenomenon. All across the world, and especially in the rich countries of the world, but increasingly in all the countries of the world, the economy has been growing at a slower and slower pace. And in the book, I attribute that to the end of the era of industrial growth. Basically, in the past, as we know, we lived in an industrial society with a rapid pace of industrial development and the creation of industrial jobs. And the industrial sector is predisposed towards very rapid and radical productivity growth and technological change. As the era of industrialization comes to an end, and deindustrialization begins, economies grow more and more slowly. And a common misconception, especially in a country like Italy, is to think that's because all the jobs are leaving places like Italy and going to poorer countries. But what you might be surprised to learn is that a lot of those regions, so for example, I'm from the United States. We always talk about how jobs are leaving the United States and going to Mexico. But what you might be surprised to learn is that Mexico has also been deindustrializing since the 1980s. You might think all the jobs, it's because all the jobs are leaving all of these countries and going to China. China experienced a very rapid period of industrialization from 2002, when it joined the WTO, until 2012. But even China has been deindustrializing now for 10 years. And China's economy is growing more and more slowly as a result. The entire world, according to the UN, is deindustrializing now for a decade. And so this process, which in my view is much more attributable to the spread of technological capacities around the world than to a particularly rapid pace of technological change. It's globalization that is really at the heart of the experience of technological and economic stagnation. But my view is that it's this stagnation tendency that's really responsible for the fact that people can't find work. Our technology appears to be a technological change appears to be unfolding at such a rapid pace in our society, only if you measure it against the yardstick of a much slower pace of economic growth. In fact, in the past, they had both much faster technological change and much faster economic growth. Our period is slower all around. But it's that slowness that's generating what I call a low demand for labor. It's the slow growth of the economy. Another way to think about it is, we don't live in an era where jobs are being destroyed at a rapid pace. Every economic measure shows we actually live in a society where people get stuck in their jobs. It's not that they're constantly changing jobs. A lot of people get stuck in jobs they can't get out of. They don't have opportunities to leave. That's the big problem. The problem is a lack of jobs being created. That's the hallmark of a stagnating economy.
And just to provide an element that might resonate with the experience of an Italian audience, when you talk about deindustrialization here in Italy and in other parts of Europe, we have been leaving it as, for instance, also the emergence of a service sector that has become so pervasive that it has basically colonized several other sectors here in Italy. And now, one point that you make in the book is that the service sector is actually important, and we should focus on it, because a couple of things happen over there in that sector in particular. Trends are even more exaggerated. For instance, what you were mentioning about productivity of labor, especially for countries like Italy, in the service sector is actually negative.
Yes.
And now this is kind of counterintuitive, because when one talks about technological innovation, and the introduction, I don't know, of artificial intelligence in the workplace and other forms of automation, the accompanying discourse is basically that this will boost the productivity of labor. So what are we dealing with here? Why does this happen?
This is a very good question. So we live in societies where the vast majority of the population, vast majority of the workforce works in services. And actually, this trend toward a service economy has now become global. Sometime in the last 2 or 3 years, the entire world's workforce became majority service-based, which is an incredible transformation in humanity. But the service sector is beset by a very deep and persistent problem that none of the technologies we've seen so far have changed. And this problem is named after a very famous American economist, a mainstream economist. He was not a radical. His name is William Baumol. And the problem he described is now called Baumol's cost disease. And what it says is that in the service sector, there's just an endemic problem of low productivity growth. It's very hard to produce more or expand the production of services without using more labor to do it, right? And so in general, in the service sector, if you want more healthcare, if you want more teachers, if you want more business services, you have to just hire more people. And as a result, services tend to become relatively more expensive over time. Hospital beds become more expensive. Education becomes more expensive. The problem is the difficulty of increasing labor productivity in that sector. And so as workers shift over to services from industry, that makes the problem of low productivity growth even worse, because it puts more and more people in these low productivity activities. It seems like information technology should really transform that. And ever since the 80s, people have said computers are finally going to resolve Balmoral's cost disease, but they never have. And part of the reason for that is that actually the information economy, which feels so important because we're all glued to our little screens, it feels like the information economy must be such a big part of the economy. But in terms of the number of people who actually work in the information economy, it's not that large. And all of the changes that information technologies have wrought have not really, it turns out, raised the productivity of teachers, nurses, doctors, business services, and so on. So as the industrial growth engine has run down, nothing, and least of all the service sector, has really been able to replace industry as a new growth engine. And that's why you get a stagnating economy that has a lot of trouble creating jobs and mostly creates these precarious or underemployed jobs where people feel really stuck and it's hard for them to advance in their lives. Of course, there are also very highly paid jobs in the service sector. The service sector, unlike industry, is much more heterogeneous. So there's always, you know, engineers and doctors who are making a lot of money. But, you know, at the bottom of the labor market, you have so many people who end up in these precarious low-wage jobs because of this stagnation tendency, because of this slow productivity tendency associated with a post-industrial economy.
And this is also a nice bridge to the second counter-argument that you make. Basically, it may be summarized by saying that we are not heading towards an era of mass unemployment, but rather of persistent underemployment. Now, this is a compelling argument, and I would like for you to develop on it, but I would also like for you to comment on a fact that has been not discovered, but actually communicated upon by the ILO, the fact that historically speaking, we are now living in an era that sees the biggest number in terms of formerly employed persons all around the world. So we have never been in such a situation, but also at the same time, a huge increase in informal economy. Yeah. So how can this phenomena be connected, in your opinion?
Yeah, so it should be said that even in Italy, there remains like a very strong core, an industrial core in the economy. And compared to where I live in the United States, Italy has a much larger percentage of its workforce still in industry. And the industry that exists here is very high tech. It's been high tech for a long time, and it continues to import, you know, the latest technologies into like very high-end car production, for example. You know, in the United States, we're down to about 7 or 8% of the workforce in industry. In Italy, it's still 15% or so. And that's a big, almost twice as large a share works in industry here. So you have these advanced technologies, you have advanced multinational companies here, as you do in the US and other countries. And what's happened everywhere in the world is that these companies that are really international producers, multinationals, they employ a stable workforce with a lot of benefits. You know, even if they lose their jobs or get laid off, they have access to a strong welfare state. And as unions and, you know, politicians have done what they can to protect this core, they've allowed the growth of this very large periphery to rise around them of underemployed workers. We've seen governments changing laws, you know, in Italy as elsewhere, to make it easier for companies to hire these workers and then fire them when they're no longer needed, right? Everywhere we see this trend, the same sorts of things that politicians are doing to make it easier to hire and fire this low wage and precariously employed workforce, and even, I'm sure here as elsewhere, to change the welfare state, to actually make it harder for those workers to access long-term unemployment benefits, to even access, you know, really good retraining services and so on. And those are all a way that, here as elsewhere, governments have tried to respond to this process of stagnation by protecting a core workforce and then allowing this pool of precarious labor to grow up around it. And basically, I think that those tendencies are really set to continue. And whatever exists here, you know, think about youth unemployment in a country like Italy, which is already, you know, and I don't say this isn't an insult, quite an old country. You know, the number of young people here is shrinking all the time, just for demographic reasons. Take the same kinds of problems that you have here and go to South Africa, right, which has a much younger population. When you have a youth unemployment rate in Spain of 35 or 40%, that's not that many people compared to a 35 or 40% underemployment rate of youth in South Africa. That's a very large part of the population. So if you go to these other places, you'll see that the size of this precarious, in the global south, it's instead called informal workforce, is truly enormous. And then on the world scale, you know, the share of the world's workforce that has stable jobs, that even has formal jobs with formal employment contracts, that represents a minority of the world's workforce. The majority of workers around the world exists in an extreme form of precarity called informality. They're employed informally and or in the informal sector. And so these are just really major problems, again, generated by the kind of sputtering of the world economy. And the few places in the world like China that were growing rapidly were creating a lot more jobs and were incorporating workers until the 2012 or so, when that process in China as elsewhere began to slow down and reverse itself.
Yeah, and this is just to follow up on that. You mentioned in the book that this, according to the OECD index of employment protection, well, the U.S. workers barely register. While on the contrary, countries like the U.K., Japan, Germany, Italy, and France are in a better shape. But surprisingly, and this is another point you make, in countries like Italy, France, but also India, Turkey, and Spain that you just mentioned, interestingly, the most staggering increase in terms of protection of the last decades has not been around the core of employed, formerly employed workers, but on the contrary, on contingent workers. And this is, again, counterintuitive, and I wonder if, in your opinion, on the one side, some policies that were put in place in those countries, I'm thinking about here in Italy 50 years ago, we introduced the notion of parasubordinazione, which means that there is something halfway between formally employed and self-employed, and this thing is equated to subordinated work, to employed. But also, it's not only a matter of government policies, it's also a matter of struggles, yes. Workers' struggles, that how they were put in place in countries like, I don't know, Argentina. You mentioned the case of the picateros. These are things that eventually make precarious work more visible on the national and international stage, and that push towards a better protection for those workers. So what do we do of this?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And even in the United States, you know, you have movements like the Fight for 15, efforts to raise minimum wages, efforts to, very important, I was talking before about Uber and Lyft and these kind of delivery companies that say, look, you know, don't pay that much attention to our workers. We're going to have all of this done by delivery bots soon, or by robot driving, you know, self-driving cars. There have been real efforts of workers, in spite of these, you know, discourses of fear, to organize themselves and to fight for legal recognition of their work and for higher wages and for protections. And these are all really important features of the present moment. And especially in the pandemic, I think we saw, you know, a need to extend to all of these precarious workers a much greater degree of protection, right? So those struggles are really important in countering some aspects of the automation discourse. And I think, I guess, what I would say, going back a little bit to what I was trying to talk about before, a lot of the stories we hear are about how all of these jobs are going to be automated out of existence. There was a very important study around 2012, 2013 by these two Oxford researchers, Frey and Osborne, that said that 47% of jobs today are going to be automated away. And journalists loved this line, and it's repeated endlessly. You still hear it talked about. But it was already the case 5 years ago that the OECD, MIT, other organizations looked at what Frey and Osborne said, reevaluated the numbers, and said, actually, these guys were wrong. They were so wrong. Like, they were wrong at the level of, you know, very basic how they coded different jobs. And the OECD and MIT reran the numbers, and what they found was that something like 12 to 14% of jobs are likely to be automated out of existence.
Actually, OECD said 9%.
9%, even less. You know, so, and that is probably less than was true in the past. The share of jobs that are going to be automated out of existence today is probably less than was true in earlier years. But what they do say is that a lot of jobs will be transformed by technology. The work isn't going to go away, but the form that work takes will change due to technology. And that makes the struggle of workers in fields that are really affected by technologies especially important, because those jobs that they're doing probably aren't going away. And so making those job conditions better for the workers doing those jobs is a really important struggle for workers and a really important kind of object of policy change in the world today.
Okay, just wanted to address probably the last point that you raise in the parse destruence of your book, because there is, you spend like, I don't know, probably 70 pages bashing prejudice and pre-notions about automation, about even about policies like the universal basic income, and this is the question I want to ask about. But then you have the final counter-argument, the final chapters of your book, which are about a constructive political proposal. And we will finish on that, and then we will open to questions and answers. But before we go to the parse constraints, let's talk about universal basic income. Universal basic income, the way you describe it, is very Elon Musk informed. How can I describe it? I mean, it's you describe it as a technocratic Silicon Valley fix for a problem that, in your opinion, is not well framed. And so it's a non-solution to the wrong problem. And I would like for you to explain this to the audience. And I also would like to put it in the context of Italy, where we had not an experimentation, but an actual policy of reddito di cittadinanza, which, of course, is has been a disaster for many reasons. And the main reason is that it was not an actual universal basic income. It was basically a workfare, unemployment insurance basic policy that we never had here in Italy. So it was supposed to be a good thing, but it never actually worked as a UBI. So universal basic income, unconditional basic income. So what can we say about it, and what's so wrong with the UBI?
I always say, you know, I'm in favor of any change in policy that makes it easier for people to survive. I think our technologies, in spite of what I'm saying, I give a very deflationary account of what's going on in the world of technology today. And we can talk about that in much more detail if you want. But I do think that we live in a world where technologies are so advanced that no one should have to worry about surviving, right? And the universal basic income proposal in its strong form is a proposal that says we should give people enough money so that they don't have to struggle to survive. And I think that's a very positive idea, and I think that's why this idea appeals to so many people. And there's a long history of where this idea comes from, of a true unconditional basic income. It means make sure everyone in society has at least this much money that they can survive. You know, sometimes it's a negative income tax. It says if you make less than the amount needed for survival, we'll give you more. Sometimes it just says every citizen gets a grant of a certain amount of money. But that's the idea, to raise the floor of society, that we live in an advanced enough society that we should be able to give this to everyone. And, you know, I think there's something very appealing about this idea. It makes so much sense. In reality, everywhere it's been introduced, it's been very low, it's been very conditional, it hasn't really been enough to survive on. It often comes with these work demands or demands to look for work, so it doesn't have the freeing character that its proponents advocate. In the book, what I say is that one of the big ideas when UBI and automation come together, because they frequently do, people who advocate this idea that we live in an era that is going to see the end of work, they often say the solution is to provide this unconditional basic income to everyone. And what they're thinking is that we live in a world where robots are going to do all the work, so people aren't going to be able to find jobs. So what we need to do is give everyone money so they can buy the stuff the robots are making. And that's a very coherent argument. It makes a lot of sense. And it makes it seem like the big problems society faces are fundamentally problems of distribution. They're questions about who gets the money and how. And we do live in a society where inequality is increasing. There are big distribution problems in our society. But the claim I'm making is that those problems are arising because the economic growth engine is really running down. It's not that we're producing more and more quickly than ever before. We are living in a society that has a lot of trouble growing, and it has trouble generating public tax dollars to pay for things. So instead of living in a society that is flush with money for whatever we want to do, we live in a society that's been beset over and over again by austerity, cuts to healthcare and education systems. Cuts have been the word on the table for a very long time. And in my view, if we did implement a basic income, it would face a lot of the same problems and calls for cuts that other welfare programs have faced. So it would be very hard to imagine in the real world we live in, not the world the automation people are projecting, but the real world we live in, it would be very hard to imagine that a universal basic income could be instituted, could be set at a high enough level, and that could then continue to grow to create this kind of post-scarcity world. Because the problem that we face, the problem we need to deal with, is a deeper problem of reconstructing the economic engine of our society. And sometimes, you know, when I talk about this, I give the example that for in the 90s and in the early 2000s, a lot of people said, all we need to do to fix climate change is just to implement a carbon tax. There's this market solution, and it's a minor fix. There's just one little problem with the market. They forgot to price carbon. And if we just put a carbon price, that will solve all the problems. Now, people increasingly don't think that. They think we need big public investments and big changes like planning to switch the infrastructure of a highly fossil fuel dependent society to a renewable energy society. They say we need a giant change in public investment. Carbon tax isn't going to be enough to do it. And in the same way, that's what I'm saying about basic income. It seems like a little fix we can make to a market society, but it turns out the problem we face is going to require a much bigger change in society, a much bigger change in how we relate to the future, basically, than what this basic income story allows us to do.
And now, to finish on a positive note, let's talk about the political proposal contained in the final chapters of your book, which, as I discovered subsequently, it's actually the topic of your next book, at the time only a manuscript, but soon will be a book about post-scarcity. So a post-scarcity society is your proposal for a society that is not fully automated and yet can live through a certain type of abundance. You also say that this post-scarcity society is not a literal cornucopia, is not necessary for us to overproduce, but you insist on some political structures or infrastructures to be put in place, or even attitude, like when you talk about cooperative justice, and this is extremely interesting, and I would like for you to develop on that. And also a quite surprising statement when you say that a post-scarcity society is a frame of mind. So what do you mean by that?
So, you know, I've been talking a lot about automation as a kind of discourse of distraction and fear, but a big part of the book I wrote is about hope in the future. Because I think that when we talk about automation, you know, and I'm explaining, well, it's not really happening the way they say it will. It's not really going to end work. It'll change work, but that means we need a real struggle over what work is going to look like. Automation is also really is a story of hope, and I think it's a really important one because it's an account that says when people talk about automation, they're saying we should get to a world where we don't have to work, and that the defining feature of that world is that we won't work, and yet we'll have everything we need, right? It's a vision of a world where people become, in a really important sense, beyond scarcity, post-scarcity, in the sense that they no longer worry about their survival. It's not the way the economists use the word scarcity. It's an older meaning of the term. And it implies this kind of, you know, when people talked about overcoming scarcity in the past, they didn't mean never having to make choices. They were referring to a world where no one has to make choices in which their survival is at stake. And that's the beautiful idea of this world of advanced technology and of, you know, automation technologies. The thing that I say in the book is we actually already have we have technology already advanced enough to produce a post-scarcity society in this sense. We could reorganize the way we work, reorganize the way that we distribute goods in a way to create a world where no one would have to worry about their survival. And that, there's a great book about this by an economist and a psychologist called Scarcity, Why Having So Little Means So Much. And what they document in this book is the incredible changes in the way people relate to their entire lives when they don't have to worry about their survival. It's incredible the way people make decisions, their openness and creativity towards problems they face. People have much more mental space when they're not worried all the time about surviving. And we already have the technologies to make a world like that. We could do that if we changed fundamental things about our economy. And you know, the difference from the vision of automation and the hope that it provides is that the world I'm describing that has this characteristic is still a world in which we would have to work. It's not to say, we wouldn't have to worry about how we organize work or organize the economy. Computers, AI, all of that stuff is going to take care of that. I'm saying, actually, it might be another 100 years before computers and AI have that possibility, if they ever do. But we need to change what we do right now. We are already, especially in a world facing climate change and stagnation, we need to change these things now, or we're going to face a world where insecurity breeds hate and fascism and ultimately prevents us from achieving the kind of coordination we need to handle and respond to climate change. So we can build that world, but it means figuring out how to share the work that remains to be done, how to organize it, how to change that work so that it corresponds to a world in which people are no longer working out of sheer necessity and fear for their survival. Another world in that sense, I think, is very possible.
Thank you very much. And I would like with this to open to a conversation with you, questions and possibly answers. And if you want, you can ask your question in Italian. We'll do our best to translate. The first person is here. I think that our splendid volunteers are supposed to give you a mic. No. Yes. Thank you very much.
Do you want to do rounds of questions?
Yeah, like we'll I think we will take two or three questions and then, yeah.
You have to help me remember.
Hello. I want to ask if we could reduce the fear of the future and increase the hope with new technologies, for example, simulating something that the people can experience in the future. And in general, how can we reduce the fear and increase the hope with the technologies or not?
Great.
Okay, second question is the gentleman over there.
Hello. Thank you for your contribution, today contribution. Some years ago, I used to read in US newspapers some trends about jobless economy and some experiment to pay some sort of salary or income to unemployment people just to avoid conflict and so on. So this, could you make a refresh about this kind of trends in the US? I'm interested in this jobless economy. And if this could be meaning an end of liberalism as we know from the past. Mm-hmm. Liberalism, not yet capitalism, but liberalism. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. So just three very quick questions. First of all, you were mentioning some of the statistics, why, how they are wrong, because, yeah, not that amount of jobs got automated, but actually the point has been made that the way we've been looking at it is totally wrong, and we should be looking in tasks instead of jobs. When we do look in tasks, then we see that, well, there is a trend there occurring, because you cannot imagine an entire job being automated. It's so complex. But when you look at how tasks are being automated, it tells a very different story of growth. Second?
Are you an economist?
No, unfortunately, a data science student. The second question is, do we really want to increase the productivity of teachers? I mean, are we really interested in that? I don't want my teacher to struggle more. I want him to give me more, which is why everybody wants to go to Cambridge and they can't, because they want that one-on-one attention. And the third, I'm interested in the unionizing our digital workers. Like, you see all this promotion of, yeah, you can be a freelancer, you know, you're a digital nomad, or all these empty words, but these people, ill-informed about the welfare state, have no idea about how to pay their pension, how to accumulate benefits, how to do any social stuff. They just want to travel and buy an Apple Watch, but there is no sense of the future among, especially the younger generation than us, you know, like, no idea about the welfare state. Thank you.
Great. Definitely not an economist.
Great.
Thank you. I would like to ask you about there's this bottleneck, all right, that is wealth distribution. That is key. I'm sure you can agree with that. With this proposal of the post-scarcity world, how do you think would be a good strategy to deal with that and with the problem with the corporativism that monopolize both income and labor distribution for the society? Thank you.
Great.
Okay.
Four great questions.
Challenge.
You'll have to help me remember
yes.
if I, because I normally
do
bring a
start,
pad
do
of paper.
Do you want to start with the first one?
Yeah, I remember though. Okay. I think I do. Yeah. So, technology is a fear and hope, right? I mean, I think that it's very interesting what you say, because one thing I think that defines the period we live in is that people find it so hard to imagine any other way of living. And, you know, I think a lot of people on the left will say something like, oh, we need community, you know, we need things that bring us together. And most people's experience of that has been social media. It has been like this incredible world of anxiety, weak connections, who has more followers than whom. You know, it's a very frightening way to experience sociality. And it makes it hard for us to imagine a different way of doing things. And so I think that, you know, there are places and times where digital technologies can really be used to help people connect in really important ways. And I think that a lot more could be done also to convince engineers to work more on those problems, right? So one thing I'm very interested in, there's a nursing collective in the Netherlands that, you know, is really like self-run nursing collectives. And they've been really impressive in defeating big mega corporations handling home healthcare. For a few reasons. One is that nurses actually prefer to work for a long time with the same patients rather than to count, like, I have 15 minutes to change this person's diaper, and then I have 12 minutes to rub their legs, and then I have to leave. You know, nurses have much better work when they actually get to work with the same people. And it turns out that doing that also improves patients' health. Patients need not only to be physically manipulated, they need to be cared for, and people are healthier when they're cared for. So this company, which I will mangle the name of, it's something like Bertzorg, but I never pronounce it correctly. They've gained like a 75% market share of home healthcare in the Netherlands, and the model's being really distributed around the world. They've also saved the Dutch government millions and millions and millions of dollars because people who are who feel cared for are healthier and then need less time in the hospital. This company has an intranet for worse nurses, where nurses connect to each other and ask each other about, you know, diseases they're experiencing in their patients or problems they're having. And it allows them to connect in a way that's not like our social media, but a different way of actually accessing information and learning and helping and trusting each other. And I think that we could do a lot more to bring out those positive examples of technology and also encouraging engineers, because we live in a society, at least in America, long time, all these engineers, they were like so excited about working at Facebook and Google and, you know, but a lot of people are realizing that those jobs, they kind of suck in a lot of ways. Sure, you have kombucha on tap, but a lot of what you're doing is like getting people to keep their eyeballs glued to computer screens, and you sort of feel like, you know, Google used to have don't be evil as one of their mottos, and they've gotten rid of it, you know? Yeah, well, so you have all these tech workers who are experiencing their own tech backlash and looking for other
probably
options.
Probably is for the best, because I wouldn't trust Google with their definition of good and evil, of
sure.
course.
So I think you know, we live in a time where we need more examples of these. There's always a lot more open possibilities for how technologies develop, and we could talk about that for a long time, but we need more emphasis on these technologies of hope than on the bad technologies we have. The next question was about jobless recoveries, which I think is a really important phenomenon. And I would emphasize that in the economics literature, they've really shown that the problem we face today is not that when the economy grows, it creates fewer jobs for every percentage point of growth. It's just that the economy isn't growing as fast, and that's why not as many jobs are being created and why there's this history of jobless recoveries. It's really true that if you take someone who's 50 years old and unemployed and looking for a job and unable to find a new job, and you just say to them, you're retired, actually. You know, you don't need to find a job anymore. We're just giving you early retirement. That is a humane solution that really improves people's mental health. It's much better to think I've contributed something to society and now I'm done than to think I am 50 years old, I cannot find a future for myself, I'm unwanted and unneeded by society, right? So those kind of things are really important changes that we can make. We can find more humane ways of dealing with the problem of job loss. I would say one thing to pay attention to that's starting these pilots is the idea of a four-day week. You know, during the pandemic, there were all these efforts at like job sharing and job reduction rather than layoffs. And there are now all of these experiments to introduce a four-day work week and to kind of think about the problem of people not having enough work in that way. I think that's a very positive possibility for us, because it speaks to the fact that we still need a lot of work to be done, but it would be better to share these stable jobs rather than to have this kind of core periphery dynamic. We can talk more about that. Tasks versus jobs. That's the point. So when those studies of task automation are done, what they show is that, you know, some of the work of a translator is going to be automated, but you're not going to get rid of a need for translators. And you might just have more translations that can be done now, you know? And no one knows on balance how many jobs are going to be created or destroyed as those jobs are being changed. In general, I'll just say again that if the economy were growing faster, so too would the demand for all of these transformed jobs. But generally, from a macro perspective, we're just seeing very slow-growing economies, and that means these partially automated jobs are definitely, you know, the demand for them is stagnating. So it's a large, we have to think of this larger macro side of things. There's
unionizing,
a third question.
Unionizing technology workers.
Yeah,
I think I skipped the one about the teacher because it strikes too close to home. I mean.
No, well, but that's true. I think, you know, I actually don't think that we should respond to the problems I'm describing by trying to figure out how to re-rev the growth engine, you know, how to get to a world of much higher productivity growth. I actually don't think it's possible. And I think a lot of the reason is what you were saying or what I was saying about the home healthcare aides. Actually, there's a work of care and connection that we don't want to automate out of existence. Students going to school on Zoom was a horrible experience for students. And I can tell you now.
And for professors.
When I've had to teach online because I'm traveling to do book talks, my students are like, oh, we can't go back to that. It was such a horrible and alienating experience. So I think, you know, we need to find a way to change the economy to adjust to a world of slower growth. A world of slower growth doesn't have to be a horrible, stagnating, and precarious economy. It can be, with a different way of organizing the economy, these can just be positive experiences that we have instead of a problem that society faces. And then, oh, wealth
distribution.
Yeah, there's no way to solve these problems without massive taxes on existing wealth. There's just no way to do it without whatever you want to call it, confiscatory, expropriating, high taxes. There's no way to do it without major taxes on wealth. And that would be an argument I would have, though I can't go into it here, with like MMT-style views. We actually have to take wealth and then use it in a public way. We need a much stronger degree of public investment, and we also need, as a result, to imagine a world where multiple different kinds of stakeholders are in control of how those funds are being used. You know, I would like to see Amazon not broken up, but transformed into a place where, you know, customers, as well as the workers in the warehouses, as well as all these engineers and technicians, are part of a conversation about how to develop and transform this massive part of our economy that is, you know, delivery and warehouse services. And I'd like to see that for a lot of different aspects of the economy, that we have a public but also more democratic and stakeholder-based control over a lot of the things that have become essential to our lives. That's only going to be possible if a lot of the wealth, look at what's happening with Twitter now. I mean, it's such a good example of what was supposedly a public, you know, what do you call that, square that had to be protected. It was a profitable company, but not highly profitable. Elon Musk says he's going to buy it and make it better. Instead, he's trying to do everything he can to make it profitable, and he's running it into the ground. It's a real sign that these things, the people like Elon Musk, he would actually be mentally a lot more healthy if people took away a lot of his money. I think personally, he would benefit
would be the humane
from
solution.
That confiscation. So it's as much for Musk and Bezos and to solve their mental problems as it is a survival issue for us to take away their wealth. Succession is real, if you've seen that TV show. That's really what the lives of those people are like. And the only thing we can do to help them is to take away their money.
Well, and on this... Thank you very much for your attention. Before, just one thing, I want to really thank you, Simona Caldera, for her translation live.
Yeah, thank you so
and
much.
And, of course, give it up for Aaron Benanav. Yeah.
Thanks.